Welcome to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like civics and government, the law, anthropology, and archaeology. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
On this program, we're joined by philosopher David Kinney, an Omidyar postdoctoral fellow at the Santa Fe Institute, SFI, who is leading this new effort called Foundations and Applications of Humanities Analytics, which seeks to help new humanities scholars study culture through computational tools and complexity science. We're also joined by SFI external professor Simon DeDeo, a cognitive scientist at Carnegie Mellon University, who is co-leading this new NEH-funded effort with David, and Carrie Cohen, SFI's Director for Education.
Thank you so much for talking with us today and for slow walking us through some of these concepts, which are very new and exciting. I would like to talk about a couple of things that you've mentioned. One is coming up with new questions or coming up with new ways of looking at things. And you've mentioned a couple of times that one of the things that using this approach can help with is dealing with really big data sets. But you also talked about looking at singular events like the French Revolution. And I'm wondering whether you use the same sort of big data to apply on a singular event. And then I want to touch on what you said, David, about how you build your model or how you build your simulation is going to inform what your outcomes are going to be. If you're looking at the French Revolution, did you build a big corpus of everything everybody was saying? And how do you weight what input you're using? How do you build that model to look at a singular event?
Right, exactly. How do you study the unrepeatable? And I'm sure David, as a philosopher, has much deeper thoughts than I, but this is something we deal with all the time. Before I came to the Santa Fe Institute, I was a physicist. In fact, I actually worked in astrophysics. And we got pretty used to this, right? You study the beginning of the universe, there's only one that we know of, right? We have only one sun. We have only one planetary system. Well, now we know of many more, but we certainly built our theories off of these singularities, you might say. You know, this is not unknown to science, but at the same time, you're absolutely right. There's a philosophical challenge here, a conceptual challenge. It doesn't quite mesh on to the kind of scientific method we all learned in grade school, right? You get 55 peas and you microwave half of them, and lo and behold, they don't grow. We only have one pea and probably been microwaved, right? So how do we learn anything about the biological world? So I think that's a big challenge for us. Then we talk about, okay, how much data do you have? A lot can happen in a revolution, right? People are talking. There's, you know, a huge number of transcripts, 40,000 speeches in our database. Some of these go on for pages and pages and pages. So you don't need a lot of time to get a lot of data. Third kind of challenge here, which is really fun, is sometimes you actually don't have a lot of data. You know, we worked on a project studying Oscar Wilde's play, The Importance of Being Earnest. This is over in 3 hours. There's not a lot there. And so what you're really asking is, how do you get a computer to pay attention? The big stuff is, how do you get a computer to remember all of this, to process all of it? But when you study this extraordinarily powerful but evanescent moment, that's a computational challenge. But I would say also it's a philosophical challenge, because you have to bring a lot to the text at that point. Oscar Wilde doesn't teach you how to read Oscar Wilde. And so how do you prepare, how do you form a computer in a way that it can even begin to make sense of it? So lots of really, really wonderful philosophical questions sitting inside here.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's not just in physics. People think of physics as sort of the science dealing with unrepeatable events or probabilities assigned to single events, because you think in quantum mechanics, you know, whether some atom decays from one state into another, it has a probability attached to it, but then it either happens or it doesn't. There's meant to be this sort of irreducible fact that there is that probability there. Those kinds of theories are all nevertheless tested by building larger ensembles, and you have to make assumptions when you build those ensembles. In evolutionary biology, people talk about the N equals one problem, which is that we know of one planet where life has developed. And so all of these rich theories we have of how it is that life develops, you know, Darwinian theory and then all the addendums onto that, that's all a sample size of one in a sense. So how do you study it? Well, you know, it's more complicated than this, but there's a sense in which you sort of project things into a broader space and you treat things as part of an ensemble and make certain assumptions about, well, here's what would happen if you change this and here's what would happen if you change that. And again, as Simon said, very different from the scientific method that we're all taught in school. And I think what is really important to understand about science is that really the best way to present scientific findings is by making those kinds of assumptions explicit. And good technical talks in the sciences do exactly this. You don't say we proved X. You say, we looked at X and found that if you assume Y and Z and postulate A and B, then sure enough, it should be the case that we would observe X with a certain probability of the time. And indeed, the fact that we observe X is good evidence for the validity of our theory. And sort of there's a mutual relationship between evidence and theory confirming each other. That's sort of what science really is. And so when we talk about bringing these kinds of scientific methods into research that's traditionally been the domain of the humanities, it's going to have to look more like that. And in some sense, sort of inaugurating and bringing in humanities people into that world is really one of the ambitions of the course. You know, we want to get to the point where a Shakespeare scholar isn't trying to, you know, prove that some play belongs in Shakespeare's late period rather than their middle period. What they're going to say is, if we define middle period this way and late period this way and look at these textual indicators of similarity between plays, then in fact, this play should be in the late period rather than the middle period, or it should be in the early period. And that's really all we can say, because science is this scaffolded thing, and I see no reason why humanities analytics should be any different.
Thank you for that explanation. That's actually really helpful for me. When I think about what you said, Simon, about trying to teach a computer what to pay attention to, or trying to apply these computational tools to the importance of being earnest, it seems like the cultural context is your wild card. I work with history students who have to be able to articulate the context of why that thing in history happened when it happened. So how do you model that context? How do you try and be objective about what is important about that context? I think for Oscar Wilde, it would be a little bit easier because it's a certain class, a certain time, a certain country with really rigorous norms of behavior, right? But with something a little bit more nebulous, like the French Revolution, I mean, you have all sorts of different classes and all sorts of different people. So how do you model that? How does that translate into something like a controlled scientific experiment?
This is a great question, Ellen. It also hooks into something that Craig talked about a little bit earlier. One of the things that we do when we want to build a model of a text, right, when we want to talk about a text scientifically, is we read one text through another. So we don't just hand the machine Oscar Wilde in this case. We don't just hand it The Importance of Being Earnest. What we actually did there was hand it two plays. We handed it The Importance of Being Earnest and A Streetcar Named Desire, Tennessee Williams. And obviously, there's a lot of good reasons to pair these plays up. They're both more or less covert icons of a queer tradition in the United Kingdom, United States. But when you read one text through another, and that's something that people in the humanities talk about, you can bring into relief one pattern over another. And I just love this result. This is work with Kent Chang, who's now somewhere on the West Coast. Kent is a scholar of queer studies, but also an information theorist, somebody in the School of Information. So you take Oscar Wilde's play, right? You have Jack and Algernon, these two male leads, right? It's quite traditional to say that this is also a friendship that goes beyond the standard Victorian friendship. When you read Oscar Wilde through Tennessee Williams, when you read The Importance of Being Earnest through A Streetcar Named Desire, one of the things you realize is that the pattern that Algernon and Jack play out is parallel to the pattern that Stanley and Stella play out. Now, Stanley and Stella in A Streetcar Named Desire, in case you guys didn't do the reading, right? Stanley and Stella are a married couple. So what we're seeing is, in one sense, what is a marriage for Tennessee Williams? It's a friendship. What is a friendship for Oscar Wilde? It's a marriage. right? So what we're able to do is surface these kind of implicit patterns that are sitting there. But we do that by, in some sense, training the computer on Oscar Wilde and having it read Streetcar and vice versa, which is, of course, how we teach a class in English literature, right? We don't just give one text, right? Certainly, we don't give an intro class where we only read Beowulf. What we do is we build people up in a canon. We teach them to read one text, and we kind of know they're not going to get it until they see it in this larger context. So I think that's one of the kind of model building tools kind of sitting there for us to make use of.
It's funny you talking about reading one text to get another text. Maybe 20 months ago, 24 months ago, Google, for their translation AI, started, instead of having humans translating words or phrases, instead they were just feeding in entire translations of complete texts. And they were including poetry, and they were including essays, and then, in a sense, training their AI to overlay these things to sort of pick out what turn of phrase or what word would be the right translation. And that's sort of what I'm hearing you describe in the way that you go about modeling this stuff. Because if you have that cross-contextualization, that's where things get useful and interesting.
Yeah, I mean, to go back to an example we had before, to strike a blow or to punch someone in the face, these are equivalent actions. But the context in which one arises versus another, the use of language, is everything. Shakespeare strikes a blow, Stanley Kowalski in Streetcar Named Desire punches someone in the face, right? So these are very different worlds. And in some sense, we think of a computer being formed, having some kind of formation through the culture. We teach it before we ask it questions.
Well, and I was thinking about your example earlier about the Old Bailey and the rise of more formal medical terminology. You know, I didn't get cut, I had multiple lacerations or something like that. And I was thinking that this sort of analytics could be useful. And of course, I'm bringing my own bias or hypothesis in here. Was it also the rise of things like autopsies and dissecting cadavers and the science of internal anatomy? Did that happen sort of at the same time that then people were describing things in more medical terms? Is that sort of what could be a goal of this kind of analytics, is to say, here's how their language changed. Are there other inferences or correspondences that we can tease out in what was happening at the same time in the same place in the sciences or in literature?
Nothing is in a vacuum. The cell phone, in some sense, changed how we saw the world, and there's no way to go back. There is no way to write a novel today. Even if you write a historical novel, there's no way to do that without being influenced by the present day, by what you're seeing. And that's a technological world, that's a social world, cultural world. To go back to this example of Oscar Wilde, you couldn't talk about certain kinds of relationships. Everything was more or less encoded. It was a pattern that some could read and others couldn't. By the time you get to Angels in America, everything's changed. That is a text interacting with, in that case, a liberation moment. Nothing is hermetically sealed.
I'd just like to add on to this briefly. You know, I think one reason why it's so important for us, especially for the in-person workshop, to connect with people doing PhDs in the humanities now is because people doing PhDs in the humanities now are going to be looking into very new areas of research within the humanities. And often that's going to be non-Western, potentially non-Anglophone materials. And I think that's really important because Simon brings up this great example of reading The Importance of Being Earnest through Streetcar Named Desire. That's a really cool research project. And there are sort of new things in terms of bringing out the queer themes, and that's fairly new within the academy. But they are Anglophone dramatic works, right? If we have a scholar coming in who's really interested in Brazilian women's slave narratives, and the question is, okay, what should we read those through? I don't know the answer to that question. I'm posing it. You need the person who studied those to say, well, actually, you know, you want to look at these Caribbean sources or maybe these sources from the American South, or maybe not, maybe something else. You know, they're going to be the expert there. And so that kind of domain expertise in the humanities, it's a great example, I think, of why we need humanitarians there when we're posing these questions.
David, what you're making me think about here is the old canon wars from the 1980s. When we read Williams through Wilde, we're setting up an implicit canon there. And that's a canon that a lot of people want to revise. And that's exciting. There's a lot of stuff that we don't read or we're just learning to read now. One of the sort of very exciting points here is that we can start reading texts in a new way and through new eyes. This is a real exciting moment in opening up, decolonizing the canon.
Just fantastic.
Such exciting work.
It's actually kind of blowing me away. Thank you both so much for being with us today on this program. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, yes.
If you would like more information about the SFI's new program in humanities analytics and their educational program that will be starting summer of 2021, you can visit santafe.edu/FAHA. Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUNM-FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music comes courtesy James Whiten, and we've had production assistance from Tristan Klum.